Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to my open house of horror, and to a series of stories from the other side of sanity. This is the second, and in the science of numerology, a science that has long intrigued me, it is said that the number two is a strongly feminine number. My story today shows a woman who is indeed strong. Surprisingly so. And it is a story which may disturb you by its implications. But the frontiers of science are forever being pushed back, and the doctor in my story acted only from the purest of motives. Could the same be said of Mary Pearl, the somewhat plump and merry widow who confided in me at a cocktail party? Yes, as I was saying, the number two has a strongly feminine aura, but let us begin not at the beginning, but rather at the end. Or was it really the end? Story number two is about William and Mary.
I am the resurrection and the life, said the Lord. He that believeth in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. And whosoever liveth and believeth in me shall never die.
So you see, Mrs. Pearl, apart from the few small bequests already mentioned, your late husband has left all his property to you. As his solicitor, I've been instructed to give you this letter. No doubt you'd like to take it home with you and read it in privacy.
Oh, thank you. Yes, yes, I'll do that. This note, my dear Mary, is entirely for you, and will be given to you shortly after I am gone. Do not be alarmed by the sight of all this writing. It is nothing but an attempt on my part to explain
to you exactly what Dr. Landy is going to do. During the past few days, I have tried very hard to speak with you about Landy, but you have steadfastly refused to give me a hearing. This is a very foolish attitude to take, and it stems mostly from ignorance. I swear to you that when you have read my story, your sense of antipathy will vanish, and I dare to hope that you will become a little proud of what your husband has done. As my time draws near, it is natural that I begin to brim with every kind of sentimentality. I have a wish, for example, to write something about you, and what a satisfactory wife you have been to me through the years. I have a yearning also to speak about Oxford, where I've been living and teaching for the past 17 years. All the things and places that I loved so well keep crowding in on me now in this gloomy hospital room, and I can see them more clearly than ever. The details of the illness that struck me down in my middle life are well known to you, and I do not need to repeat them here. Suffice it to say that I admit at once how foolish I was not to have gone earlier to my doctor. 6 weeks ago, John Landy came to see me. He is a magnificent neurosurgeon, much involved with the varying effects of prefrontal lobotomies upon different types of psychopath. Maybe you have never met him, but he and I have been friendly for at least 9 years. And the moment he entered my room, I knew there was some sort of madness in the wind.
William, my boy, this is perfect. You're just the one I want.
Good day to you, John. Do take a pew. How may I be of help?
Now, look. In a few weeks, you are going to be dead, correct?
So it would seem.
And then they'll take you out and cremate you.
Bury me.
That is even worse. And then what? Do you believe you go to heaven?
I doubt it. Though it would be comforting to think so.
Or hell, perhaps.
I don't really see why they should send me there.
Well, you never know, my dear William.
Well, what is all this about, John?
Well, personally, I don't believe that after you're dead, you'll ever hear of yourself again. Unless you have the sense to put yourself into my hands. I'm really serious about it, William. Would you care to consider a proposition?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Then listen and I'll tell you.
Go on, then, if you like. I doubt if I've got very much to lose by hearing it.
On the contrary, you have a great deal to gain, especially after you're dead. This is a thing, William, that I've been working on quietly for some years. One or two others here at the hospital have been helping me. We've completed a number of fairly successful trials with laboratory animals. I'm at the stage now when I'm willing to have a go with a human. It's a big idea, and it may seem a bit far-fetched at first. But from a surgical point of view, there doesn't seem to be any reason why it shouldn't be more or less practicable. Now, quite a long time ago, I saw a short medical film that had been brought over from Russia. It showed a dog's head, completely severed from the body, but with the normal blood supply being maintained through the arteries and veins by a means of an artificial heart. Now, the thing is this. That dog's head, sitting there all alone on a sort of tray, was alive.
I find that difficult to believe.
I tell you, the brain was functioning. They proved it by several tests. For example, when food was smeared on the dog's lips, the tongue would come out and lick it away, and the eyes would follow a person moving across the room. Now then, my own thought is to remove the brain from the skull of a human being and keep it alive and functioning as an independent unit for an unlimited period after he is dead. Your brain, for example.
No,
don't interrupt, William. So far as I can tell, the brain is a peculiarly self-supporting object. The magic processes of thought and memory which go on inside it are manifest there, not impaired by the absence of limbs or trunk or even of skull, provided that you keep pumping in the right kind of blood under the proper conditions.
Yes, but
my dear William, just think of your own brain. It is in perfect shape. It is crammed full of a lifetime of learning. It soon it is going to die, along with the rest of your body, simply because your silly little pancreas is riddled with cancer.
No, thank you. You can stop there. It's a repulsive idea. And even if you could do it, it would be quite pointless. What possible use is there in keeping my brain alive if I couldn't talk or see or hear or feel? Personally, I can think of nothing more unpleasant.
Ah, but I haven't told you about the eye yet.
Huh?
We might even succeed in giving you a certain amount of vision. Now, listen. I would try to leave one of your optic nerves intact as well as the eye itself. The beauty of it is that it's not really a nerve at all. It's an outpouching of the brain and is attached to the eyeball. So the back of the eye is in very close contact with the brain, you see?
How convenient.
Oh, I'm afraid there wouldn't be any muscles there to move it around. But it might be sort of fun to lie there quietly and peer out at the world.
Hilarious. How about leaving me an ear as well?
Oh, I'd rather not try an ear this time.
I want an ear. I insist upon an ear.
No, no.
I want to listen to Bach.
You don't understand how difficult it would be. The hearing apparatus is a far more delicate mechanism than the eye. You really must leave me to decide what is possible and what isn't.
You talk as if it's all arranged. I tell you, I don't fancy the idea.
Would you rather be dead altogether?
Perhaps I would. I don't know yet. I wouldn't be able to speak, would I?
Oh, of course not.
Then how could I communicate with you? What if it turned out to be terribly painful and I couldn't stand it? No legs to run away on, no voice to scream with. How would you know if I were conscious?
Oh, that part would be easy. An ordinary electroencephalograph could tell us that. We'd attach the electrodes to the frontal lobes of your brain.
But I couldn't communicate with you.
As a matter of fact, I believe you could.
Huh?
There's a man up in London called Wertheimer who's doing some interesting work on the subject of thought communication. You know the brain throws off electrical discharges rather like radio waves.
I know a bit about it, yes.
Well, Wertheimer has constructed an apparatus which produces a kind of graph which is apparently decipherable into words and thoughts. Would you like me to ask him to come and see you?
You're assuming that I believe any of this nonsense now. Why don't you just go away and leave me alone? That's a good chance.
I think that's a very short-sighted attitude. You'll be fascinated when you hear about the actual operation itself. Come to all that later on. The fact remains that you are going to die fairly soon, whatever happens. And my plans would not involve touching you until after you are dead. Now, come now, William. No true philosopher could object to lending his dead body in the cause of science. After all, you carry a donor card, don't you?
That's hardly the same thing. And it seems to me there'd be some doubts as to whether I were dead or alive by the time you'd finished with me.
Well, I suppose you're right about that. But I don't think you ought to turn me down just yet before you know a bit more about it.
I've heard more than enough already, thank you. I can do without the gory details.
No, don't be depressed, man. Here, would you like a cigarette?
I don't smoke, you know, that disgusting habit.
Well, may I go on?
I'd rather you didn't.
I think you'll find it quite interesting. At the moment of death, I should have to be standing by so that I could step in immediately and try and keep your brain alive.
You mean leaving it in my head?
Well, to start with, yes, I'd have to.
And where would you put it after that?
Well, if you want to know, in a sort of basin.
Are you really serious about this?
Certainly I'm serious.
All right, go on.
Well, I suppose you know that when the heart stops and the brain is deprived of fresh blood and oxygen, its tissues die very rapidly. Anything from 4 to 6 minutes and the whole thing is dead. So I should have to work quickly to prevent this from happening. But with the help of the machine, it should be all quite simple.
What machine?
The artificial heart. We've got a nice version here in this hospital, which can do all the necessary things. It's really not at all complicated. Now, let me explain. You see, the blood supply to the brain is derived from 2 main sources. The internal carotid arteries and the vertebral arteries. And the return system is even simpler. The blood is drained away by only 2 large veins, the internal jugulars. Around the brain itself, they naturally branch out into other channels, but they don't concern us.
All right. Imagine I've just died. What is the first thing you would do?
I should immediately open your neck and locate the 4 arteries. I should then stick a large hollow needle into each. These 4 needles would be connected by tubes to the artificial heart. Then I would dissect up the left and right jugular veins and hitch them to the heart machine as well to complete the circuit. You wouldn't be like that Russian dog, though. For one thing, you'd certainly lose consciousness when you died, and I very much doubt if you'd come to again for quite a long time, if at all. But, conscious or not, you'd be in rather an interesting position, wouldn't you? You'd have a cold dead body and a living brain. We could now afford to take our time. And believe me, we'd need it. The next thing we'd do would be to wheel you to the operating theater. Now, it's important that you should know precisely what is going to happen to you all the way through. You see, afterwards, when you regain consciousness, it'll be much more satisfactory from your point of view if you're able to remember exactly where you are and how you came to be there. If only for your own peace of mind. So, the next problem is to remove your brain from your dead body. The body is useless. In fact, it has already started to decay. The skull and the face are also useless. They're both encumbrances. All I want is your brain. The clean, beautiful brain, alive and perfect. So, now I'm going to take this small oscillating saw and proceed to remove the whole vault of your skull. Could be rather painful. But as I'm sure you're quite unconscious, William, I won't have to bother with an anesthetic of any kind. Now, William, I've got the upper half of your skull off so that the top of the brain, wrapped in its outer covering, is exposed. And the next step is the really tricky one. I've got to release the whole package so that it can be lifted cleanly away, leaving the stubs of the arteries and veins hanging underneath to be reconnected to the machine. This is an immensely lengthy and complicated business involving the delicate chipping away of much bone. To do this, I shall now take this and slowly bite off the rest of your skull. And begin to peel it off downward like an orange, until the sides and underneath of the brain are fully exposed. It's all right, I've plenty of time, because the artificial heart is continually pumping away alongside the operating table. Now, your brain is connected to your body only at the base by the spinal column and the veins and arteries. So I am now severing your spinal column just above the first cervical vertebra. Taking great care not to harm the two vertebral arteries which are in the area. Now, William, I'm ready for my final move. On this side table, I have a basin of a particular shape, and it is filled with what we call Ringer's solution. That is a special kind of fluid we use in neurosurgery. At this point, I'm cutting your brain completely loose by severing the supply arteries and the veins. Clamp, please. Quickly, nurse. Thank you. So, I pick your brain up in my hands and transfer it to the basin. Here, don't worry. It'll only take me a moment to reconnect your veins and arteries to the artificial heart. There you are. Your brain is now in the basin. And still alive, I hope. And there isn't any reason why it shouldn't stay alive for a long time. You'll be delighted to know that I have managed to leave one of your optic nerves intact, as well as the eye itself. Now, I'm putting your eye into the small plastic case I've constructed for it. To take the place of a socket. And your eyeball is rising to float on the surface of the liquid. There now. Your eyeball, in its case, is staring up at the ceiling. I'm sorry I couldn't leave you an ear as you wanted, William, but if your eye works, it doesn't matter all that much about your hearing. We can hold up messages for you to read. And now, so that we can tell whether you regain consciousness, we'll attach these electrodes to the frontal lobes of your brain, there in the basin. And the electroencephalograph will register your thought waves. How lucky you are. Your thinking is no longer influenced by your senses. You are living in an extraordinarily pure and detached world. Nothing to bother you at all, not even pain. No worries or fears of pains or hunger or thirst. Not even any desires. Your brain could stay alive for 200 or 300 years in circumstances like these. Well, goodbye for now, William. I'll drop in and see you tomorrow.
I lay in bed thinking for a long time after John Landy left. There was something basically repulsive about the idea that I myself should be reduced to a small, slimy blob
lying in a pool of water. Then my mood began to change, and I found myself able to examine Landy's proposals in a more reasonable light. I am rather proud of my brain. As brains go, it is a damn good one. Landy has assured me that when my brain is in the basin, I shall be able to think and reason as I can now. Even the power of memory will remain. Well, Mary, as you know, I have tried to discuss this subject with you many times, but you have refused to give me a hearing. Therefore, when he comes to see me tomorrow, I shall tell him straight out that I'm going to do it. I won't say goodbye to you, because there's a tiny chance that if Landy succeeds in his work, I may actually see you again. I am giving orders that these pages shall not be delivered to you until a week after my death. Be good when I am gone, and always remember that it is harder to be a widow than a wife. Be diligent and dignified in all things. Be thrifty with your money. Do not drink cocktails. Do not smoke cigarettes. Do not eat pastry. Do not use lipstick. Do not buy a television apparatus. And incidentally, I suggest that you have the telephone disconnected.
Now that I shall have no further use for it. But before doing so, please give Landy a call to see how things went with me.
I'm so glad you called at last, Mrs. Pearl. You're quite well, I hope.
I wonder if you would care to come over here to the hospital. Then we can have a little chat. I expect you are very eager to know how it all came out. Well, I can tell you now that everything went pretty smoothly. Far better, in fact, than I was entitled to hope. It's not only alive, Mrs. Pearl, it's conscious. Isn't that interesting? And the eye is seeing. We're sure of that because we get an immediate change in the deflection on the encephalograph when we hold something up in front of it. And now we're giving it the newspaper to read every day.
Which newspaper?
Oh, the Daily Mirror. The headlines are larger.
Oh, he hates the Mirror. Give him the Times.
Very well, Mrs. Pearl. We'll give it the Times. We naturally want to do all we can to keep it happy.
Him. Not it. Him.
Him. Yes. Yes, I beg your pardon. To keep him happy. That's one reason why I suggested you should come along here as soon as possible. I think it'd be good for him to see you. You could indicate how delighted you are to be with him again. Smile at him and blow him a kiss, all that sort of thing. It's bound to be a comfort to him to know that you're standing by.
Well, you mustn't be surprised by what he looks like, Mrs. Pearl.
No, I won't.
It's bound to be a bit of a shock to you at first. He's not very prepossessing in his present state, I'm afraid.
I didn't marry him for his looks, Doctor.
Ah. Well, take your time when you get inside the room. He won't know you're in there until you place your face directly above his eye.
Dr. Adams!
The eye's always open, but he can't move it at all, so the field of vision's very narrow. At present, we have it looking straight up at the ceiling. And, of course, he can't hear anything. We can talk together as much as we like. In here. Well, I wouldn't go too close yet. So stay back here a moment with me until you get used to it all. He's in that big enamel bowl, that white bowl over there. Come, just a little closer. Not too near. That's the eye in there. Can you see it?
Yes.
Well, so far as we can tell, it's still in perfect condition. It's his right eye. And the plastic container has a lens on it, similar to the one he used in his own spectacles.
Staring at the ceiling all the time can't be much fun.
Oh, don't worry. We're in the process of working out a whole program to keep him amused. But we don't want to go too quickly at first.
Give him a good book.
Oh, we will. Are you feeling all right, Mrs. Pearl?
Yes.
Then we'll go forward a little more, shall we? And you'll be able to see the whole thing. There you are. This is William.
Oh, goodness, isn't he large? He looks like an enormous pickled walnut.
You'll have to lean over and put your pretty face right above the eye. He'll see you then and you can smile at him and blow him that kiss. If I were you, I'd say a few nice things as well. He won't actually hear them, but I'm sure he'll get the general idea.
He hates people blowing kisses at him. I'll do it my own way, if you don't mind. Hello, dear. It's me, Mary. Are you feeling all right, William? Your eyeball looks quite interesting. That network of tiny red veins. And there are little dark streaks in the iris, although it's so blue. Ice blue. I never noticed them before. I got your letter, dear, and came over at once to see how you were. Dr. Landy says you're doing wonderfully well. Oh, perhaps if I talk slowly, you can understand a little of what I am saying by reading my lips. I'm sure you're watching me. You look so calm and kindly like this, William. Almost cow-like. With that soft, gentle look in your eye. Are you quite sure he's conscious, Doctor?
Oh, yes. Yes, completely.
And he can see me?
Perfectly.
Isn't that marvellous? I expect he's wondering what happened.
Oh, not at all. He knows perfectly well where he is and why he's there. He can't possibly have forgotten that.
You mean he knows he's in this basement?
Of course. And if he only had the power of speech, he'd probably be able to carry on a completely normal conversation with you this very minute.
But you can't talk, can you, dear? No arguments and criticisms. No ban on smoking. No shirts to wash and iron. No meals to cook. I could live very comfortably with you as you are now, William.
Are you all right, Mrs. Pearl?
What? Oh, yes. Thank you, Dr. Landy. I was just thinking, I do believe I'm suddenly getting to feel the most enormous affection for him. Does that sound strange?
I think it's quite understandable.
He looks so helpless and silent lying there under the water in his little basin. Like a baby. Well, that's what he's like. He's exactly like a little baby. There, William, my pet.
From now on, Mary's going to look after you all by herself. And you've nothing to worry about in the world.
It's almost as if he's trying to say something to us.
When can I have him back home, Doctor?
I beg your pardon?
I said, when can I have him back? In my own house.
Oh, you're joking.
Why should I joke?
We couldn't possibly be moved.
I don't see why not.
Well, this is a scientific experiment, Mrs. Pearl.
It's my husband, Dr. Landy.
Well, I...
It is my husband, you know.
But that is rather a tricky point. Your husband was buried only a couple of days ago. You are a widow now, Mrs. Pearl.
I want him back. Would you care for a cigarette, Doctor?
No, thank you. Shall we go back to my room now? Smoking isn't really permitted in the laboratories. The way out is over here.
Yes, that's right. I'll be with you in a moment. I want a private word with my husband. Oh.
Mary's leaving now, sweetheart. And don't you worry about a single thing, you understand? We're going to get you right back home where we can look after you properly just as soon as we possibly can. And listen, dear. Don't you like the nasty cigarette smoke, William? I can see you didn't. You're looking at me just as you used to.
Come on, Mrs. Pearl. Come on.
Don't look so cross, William. It isn't any good looking cross just because you've got smoke in your eye. Not anymore, it isn't. Because from now on, my pet, you're going to do exactly what Mary tells you. Now, do you understand that?
Mrs. Pearl.
So don't be a naughty boy again, will you, my precious? Naughty boys are liable
yes,
to
on.
Get punished. That's
enough, Mrs. Pearl. Come on.
Goodbye, darling. I'll be back soon. Isn't he sweet?
Yes.
Isn't he heaven
yes,
tonight? I can't wait to get him home.
And one day soon, William, there'll be a little telly of your own hanging from the ceiling so we can watch the programs together. Won't that be nice?
Think about William when you go to bed tonight and close your eyes. William can never close his eye. For him, there is no sleeping and waking to separate his days. Just one long, continuous viewing of everything he hates. In the story today, Joss Ackland played Dr. Landy, and Elizabeth Morgan was Mary. William was played by Alan Dudley, and John Badley was both priest and solicitor. William and Mary was written by Roald Dahl, dramatized by Jill Brook, and directed by Jerry Jones. My name is Edward D'Souza, the man in black, and I'll be here next week with story number 3. And as you know, things happen in threes. Things certainly happen next week. Until then, be nice to each other.